The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. State Representative Kevin Windham entered the Missouri legislature as a relatively young man compared to his colleagues. But as he prepares to depart Jefferson City, the St. Louis County Democrat has accumulated quite a bit of experience in legislative politics. And on the latest episode of Politically Speaking, Windham describes what could be changed about the General Assembly and what he was proud to have contributed to during his 6 years in office. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me from mid-Missouri, she covers all things state government and state politics for St. Louis Public Radio.
Sarah Kellogg.
And joining us perhaps for the last time, maybe ever, depending on what his future plans are, he is a soon-to-be former state legislator who represents a portion of Mid and North St. Louis County.
Kevin Windham.
Thank you so much for joining us today. You decided to end your bid for a final two-year term after you won your primary unopposed. What prompted you to cut your tenure in the Missouri House short?
Yeah, so after 6 years in the Missouri legislature, I decided to withdraw from the November 2024 ballot in order to take a job opportunity as the assistant director for community engagement with Washington University.
What kind of drew you to that particular job from WashU?
Yeah, so I've been working in the legislature on higher education issues since entering the legislature. And with the natural bridge, if you will, no pun intended, with a main road in my district between community engagement, being a state legislator, and the work on higher education issues that I've been doing, I just thought it was a natural fit.
This isn't the first time somebody has left the state legislature early because they found another professional opportunity, whether it be more lucrative financially or more fulfilling personally. Do you think that maybe you would have stayed longer if, for example, legislators were paid more money or their term limits were different? Like, what would there have been anything to change your mind if things were a little bit different?
That's a good question, Jason. And if I was still an active politician, I probably wouldn't. The best answer wouldn't be to say that pay makes a difference in staying a legislator or not. But I think that if the pay was different, then it's possible that I would have stayed in the legislature. Now, probably only for two more years because of what could be a whole nother conversation of term limits.
Which we will talk about later in the show, by the way.
But I think that it's possible. So when I left Southeast Missouri State from college, I was making about $31,000 a year from a job offer at Caleres, and I went to work in D.C. working for Senator McCaskill and made a little bit more. I still make about the same amount as I made when I left college as a state legislator. So it's kind of hard to maintain that financially. And that's one of the reasons that prompted my change in career.
Because you ended up resigning after you won your primary, members of the St. Louis County Democratic Central Committee chose your replacement, Marla Smith. How do you think Representative-elect Smith will handle her transition into the Missouri House?
I think she'll handle it well. I think that the process by which the Democratic Central Committee selects replacements can be hit or miss, but I think this time is going to be a hit. So Marla Smith is a former court clerk in St. Louis County, and I think that once she gets over that natural transition period that any new legislator has, she'll be off to the races, and she'll be a great legislator for the district.
You entered the Missouri House at a very young age. I believe you were 24 or 25. What do you think were the benefits and drawbacks to starting your state legislative service so early?
So one of the benefits that we already spoke about was being younger. I had a little bit less financial responsibility, so I was able to maintain on a more modest salary. And one of the drawbacks was that folks saw me as sometimes inexperienced because of my age. And I think that after a while, I was able to, and not too long of a while, I was able to combat that just by showing folks that not only did I know a little bit about what I was doing, but I was also able to be collegial. The generation of politicians, and maybe more so politicians than politics, has changed since I've entered politics. So I entered politics in one way in 2014 after the killing of Mike Brown and the Ferguson uprising. And officially I entered politics in 2019, right after Governor Greitens was expelled
He expelled himself because he resigned, but he was about to be impeached and possibly thrown out of office. But continue.
Yeah, so much has happened. I think that the generation of leadership, though, when you think about myself and Representative Prouty and Senator Brian Williams, as well as Congressman-elect Wesley Bell and Congresswoman Bush, just that new age of leadership coming into office. Even when you think about locally on the city level, Rasheen Aldridge and some of those other younger older people coming into place, I think has really changed politics and probably the personalities at play a little bit more than some of the policies. But we've also seen some great policy change, whether that be in the realm of higher education or community revitalization and housing.
The House tends to be kind of more of a hierarchy than the Senate, meaning that the party's membership rarely diverges from GOP leadership during votes that actually matter. How do you think that changed how the legislature functioned?
I don't think that it's changed how the legislature's functioned. To my disappointment, I think that it's really stayed the same. So I think that's probably how the House has always functioned, even probably more heavily before term limits. So it was a little bit disappointing to see that it's still very heavily based on the speaker's motives on the House side. We saw new rules pretty well every year or every General Assembly that I've been in place that expanded the speaker's power. So whether that be the amount of bills that a legislator could file or different procedures that a legislator could use on the floor, with it being amendments on the floor or different other things. In that sense, I think that the speaker and leadership in the House really has took more of a grasp over time on the powers that the legislators should have.
You know, you've often had Republican House leadership complain about the slow pace of the Senate, where filibusters can prevent major bills from going forward. Did you share that same frustration? Why or why not?
Generally, I was less upset with that because that meant that less bad things happened. Sometimes that meant that that good bills got caught in the crosshairs. But, you know, I think that the Senate has a more deliberative process by design. And if I had to take one side or the other, I'd say that the House should probably take more of that same deliberative approach rather than being more hasty and sending over more bills to the Senate. I think that that probably goes along with one of the other things that really gets under my skin about the House and that the number of omnibus bills that we file. We wait until the last minute of the legislature and we pile a bunch of bills into one big bill that are loosely related. And then sometimes it's a tough decision on if you want to take a vote on, for instance, a bill that has land banking in it as well as a bill that has eviction moratoriums in it or restricting eviction moratoriums.
Yeah, you kind of sound like Senator Mike Moon there. Because, like, he didn't like omnibus bills either. So there seems to be some bipartisan disdain of that practice. But again, given that the legislature is only in session for 4.5 months, and it seems like they front load a lot of the actual finished products to, like, the last week or two, isn't, like, an omnibus bill kind of inevitable under those circumstances?
It's inevitable under those circumstances, but those circumstances aren't inevitable. So we don't have to do it the way that we've done it. I think that it's more than one reason why we should take a faster pace earlier in the session. And that's not only because of the omnibus bills that feeds into a lot of the different things. And I think that if we come to a point where 4 months still isn't long enough, then there should be a push to lengthen session, make session longer. Now, I'm not saying that that's something that we need to do, but I think that the first step in that would be working all the way throughout the year rather than taking long recesses or having days early in a session where we gavel in and gavel out. And sometimes even halfway through session when we're fighting with the Senate, if we had legislators and specifically in leadership that were better able to work together, then we wouldn't have to have so many of those empty sessions that Sarah sat throughout.
Do you think that Democrats were treated fairly in the House, given that, unfortunately, like, you all are so outnumbered that Republicans could hypothetically do anything without your help?
I don't know. I think that it probably depends on the Democrat that you ask. If we're talking about Democrats generally, no, I don't think that we were treated fair. I think that at risk of sounding old and showing some of the gray hairs on the top of my head that the legislature may or may not have given me, life's not fair, right? So I think that depending on the Democrat or legislator generally or broadly, then they were able to overcome those hurdles in various ways. So it was a number of different times and different ways where I feel like I was treated unfairly. But overall, I feel like I'm satisfied with the end result of the things that I was able to get done. I went home frustrated probably 80 to 90% of the days that I left the beautiful building that the Missouri legislature resides in our Missouri capital. But the 10 to 20% that I went home satisfied was more than worth the frustration.
Yeah, because you were on the budget committee. Were you on the budget committee your entire time in the House?
I was not on the budget committee my first term, but I was on the budget committee my second and third term.
Democrats really seem to have a lot of success in the budgetary process. I think I know the reason why, but rather than, like, me answer the question for you, like, why do you think that was an area where your caucus, which is traditionally, like, the least powerful group of people in Jefferson City, like, and this was the case when the House Democrats had 70 members. They don't have the filibuster ability. So they're just generally just not as powerful as Senate Democrats. Why do you think that you were able to get so much stuff done through the budget?
Well, I think that there's a couple of different reasons. I think that probably the easiest to point out would be that Democrats in the House are able to combine their efforts, if you will, with Republicans in the Senate, and senators more broadly at that point, to be able to work on conference committee to get some of those House Democrats' efforts passed. But I think that something that can sometimes be more difficult to see is the amount of work that House Democrats put in behind the scenes, even before the legislature begins or after it ends, whichever way you want to put it, working with our colleagues on both sides of the chambers, both sides of the aisle, and really convincing folks that money should be moved, right? So I never said this out loud and never thought about it until you just asked this question, but there's no red and blue in the budget committee. Sometimes it's just green, right? It's all about making sense with the state's money and the state's resources that we have. So I think that the easiest way to put it is that there's a meeting of the minds between House Democrats and Senate Republicans, but it's also a lot of magic, if you will, that goes on behind the scenes.
Were there any Republican lawmakers that you had particular respect for, even if you didn't agree with them on issues? I'd be interested to hear if there are any that come to mind.
I didn't have a response top of hand, but after thinking about it for a short period of time, and especially after this past session, I would have to say Senator Curtis Trent.
Okay.
Senator Curtis Trent. I can probably count on one hand the amount of times that I've agreed with him, but I think that especially after his first, I don't know if he's had a full term yet, maybe 2 years
he's
in the
been
Senate.
There. Yeah, he's been there for 2 years.
After his first 2 years in the Senate, I can say that he's shown himself so far to be a statesman. I served with him for 4 years in the House, and that's where I disagree with him a lot, even on things that seem to be easy to agree on. One thing that comes to mind is he wanted to name a road or something or another after the namesake of his county, Greene County. And it came up in conversation, well, was the namesake of Greene County a slaveholder? And he was. And eventually that piece of legislation was withdrawn. So I can appreciate that. And I don't know that that's a story that even Senator Trent appreciates to this day, but I can appreciate someone really being able to meet.
Yeah, you would have to rename a lot of counties if you didn't want them named after slave owners. Washington County, Jefferson County,
yeah.
Madison County. I assume James Madison was a
slaveholder.
But like... Jackson County, I think there actually have been people who are like, Andrew Jackson was a terrible human being.
Yeah.
He should not be named. We should not name the second biggest county in Missouri after him. But that's probably a story for another day.
No, he was not a very nice guy, Andrew Jackson. But so that was the conversation, though. We weren't talking about renaming counties. We were talking about naming new things going mm-hmm. forward, right? So it's not necessarily do we want to bellyache about things of the past, if you want to use the word bellyache. That's not, but if you want to talk about events in the past or if you want to talk about going forward, what we want to do as a state going forward I can appreciate not naming things after slaveholders going forward, at least.
What were some of the legislative or budgetary accomplishments that you were particularly proud of in your tenure?
So that's like almost choosing between my favorite kids. And I don't have any kids, but one of my favorites is being able to rework some language in the budget and eventually get Lincoln University full funding of its land grant line item. And I would say if I had to rank them, followed closely by fully funding scholarships for the first time in the state in over a decade, so since before I was in college. So Lincoln University, it's been underfunded, depending on your source, between $40 million and $300 million depending on if you use the research from the Department of Education or if you use the research from APLU, the Association for Public Land Grant Universities. So one thing is clear is that Lincoln University has been underfunded, and in my tenure I was able to in part be responsible for fully funding the land grant university for the past couple years. That's especially important to me. And then being a person that came out of college with $60,000 in student loan debt, being able to help negate some of that debt for future students and borrowers was something that was important to me and was certainly a win when and worth that 80% of the frustration that I went through in the legislature.
What were some of the things that you didn't get done that you feel like were missed opportunities?
I've been trying to be really optimistic, and you're gonna make me be pessimistic, Sarah.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. One of the things that I think is common sense and could be really small to some people and be make or break to others that I think didn't get done, but did get a chance to get heard and had some conversation about, was a statute that's currently in Missouri law that says that after someone is pulled over and has a traffic stop and is arrested, that their car is to be removed in a timely fashion from the traffic stop. So for some departments or police officers, timely can mean immediately after that person is arrested and put in the police car. For other police departments or police officers, that could mean that it's 48 hours or an indefinite amount of time. So that has an impact when, just to give you a scenario, for instance, if a teenager is driving the family's minivan and is pulled over and arrested for whatever, and the family's minivan gets towed on a Friday evening, and that family has to go without its only mode of transportation for a weekend, that could be devastating, not only to the social fabric of their family for a short period of time, but also financially for their family, because tow fees can be hundreds of dollars depending on where the car is towed from.
We'll be right back after this quick break with State Representative Kevin Windham. And we're back on Politically Speaking with soon-to-be former State Representative Kevin Windham. He is a Democrat from Uplands Park?
Uplands Park, Hillsdale,
yeah.
Normandy, generally, and broadly.
Yes. Beautiful cities in St. Louis County.
Do you think that the legislature would be more effective if term limits were either relaxed or changed to, say, having someone be able to serve 16 years in one chamber instead of basically 8 years in each?
I do. I think that I can't necessarily speak for how much good it would do to ease those term limits, but I do at least think that it would be good to remove term limits overall. I don't know exactly what a life of 16 years in each chamber would look like, or 16 years for a legislator to be able to use in either chamber. But I imagine it would be better than what happens now, because there have been a number of criticisms of term limits, and I think that some are true and some are not, but I err on the side of not having them.
You know, there are people who argue that term limits actually empower lobbyists and staffers because they are able to, you know, be there longer than lawmakers. Do you think that's true? And secondly, do you think that's a bad thing?
If I had to say yes and no, I say yes, yeah, true. I don't think that it has to be true. I think that there are opportunities for legislators to be able to exercise more of their authority, and I think that may be happening in some ways in the legislature right now. But I think that overall, if I had to say who has more influence in the way that the legislature is set up now, just the lobbyists and the folks that have been there longer, whether that be staffers or whether that be nonprofit folks, they just know more. They have more history, and sometimes that can be a bad thing, but sometimes that can also be a good thing. So I've had a number of lobbyists let me know that this isn't the first time that we fought X fight, whether that be in elections committee or whether that be on the floor speaking about LGBTQ matters. This isn't the first time we fought it, and this is what happened last time, and that's able to give you a better frame of reference when you come in and you try to have these debates on the floor.
Well, let's segue into politics a little bit, because I've found you to be a keen observer of the political scene, which is kind of separate from the legislative scene, although the two do intermix quite a bit, so I want to make that clear. Why do you think Democrats have had such a hard time gaining ground in state legislative and statewide races in Missouri?
First reason would be term limits, and I talked about that a little bit. The second thing, I think that it's just much more difficult to speak to people nowadays. And I mean that in as many ways as you can think about it, right? Whether we're talking about knocking on doors and sending out mailers, the more traditional ways that politicians have been in contact with their constituents, or whether we're talking about the new media, if you will. So streaming and all of those different things. Money still plays such a big part in politics. And I think that those two things probably go hand in hand. But I think that with messaging and the way that media is transforming is a big part. It's not the reason in that, but I think that it's just a bit of a change. And I think that it's somewhat of a natural change. I think that in 15 to 20 years, we'll be having this same conversation about Democrats having a lock on the legislature, at least hopefully. But yeah, times are just changing, I think.
This past election, we saw no coattails whatsoever from Amendment 3, which is the measure legalizing abortion. Do you think the initiative petition process isn't the magic bullet to solve Democratic woes, as people think? Or do you think that's actually kind of a misunderstanding of what the initiative petition process is kind of supposed to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that you probably answered it at the end of your question. I think it's the initiative petition process is a bit misunderstood. I think that it's possible for initiative petitions to have coattails, but I don't think that it's inevitable by any means. I think that Amendment 3 was an initiative petition that stood on its own. I think that, and I wasn't as keen of an observer as Jason maybe gives me credit for on this past election cycle. But I think that Amendment 3 was independent in that there wasn't a ton of politicians on the pro-Amendment 3 side. Now, I think that there were probably more even on the anti-Amendment 3 side, on the no side. But I think that it was able to prove itself on its own merits. And if we think about an initiative petition similar to Prop A in 2018, where there was a lot more political influence in terms of individual personas, if you will, individual politicians on the yes on Prop A side, I think that you saw a bit of a boost in that election. But that was during the primary. That wasn't during the November election. So it wasn't as observable to some.
Yeah, and Prop A was the measure that repealed Right to Work, and that was done in August. So there was no coattails for that in the general election, but continue.
Yeah, but if you look at some of those primary elections in terms of who showed up more, Democrats or Republicans, there were districts where there were seats held by Republicans, but the Democrats had more primary votes.
Yeah.
So I think that it depends on a number of things to draw this answer to a close. It depends on a number of things if an initiative petition is able to have coattails or not, but I don't think it's inevitable by any means.
Something that Senator-elect Stephen Wimber mentioned in 2021 is that if Democrats don't expand leadership beyond St. Louis, Kansas City, and Columbia, then the GOP legislature will continue to chip away at Democratic autonomy and Democrat-leading places. An example of that is the recent spat over the St. Louis County prosecutor appointment. Is that something to worry about?
Yeah, I think it's something to worry about. And I think that it's something to worry about throughout the country. So in Missouri, that looks like a number of different things from, like you mentioned, the most recent spat, if we can call it that, between the St. Louis County Executive and the Missouri Governor on who gets to name the next county prosecutor. Or we can talk about local autonomy of St. Louis City's Police Department. We can talk about nationally in Tennessee and how the Tennessee legislature went after Nashville, or in Mississippi, how the legislature went after their local Democratic cities. I think that it's somewhat of an era of overreach. This isn't happening just here, and it's not happening just right now. It's something that's going to happen over the next however long until there's at least more parity in the legislature and throughout state politics more broadly.
Well, moving closer to home in St. Louis County politics, which Sarah just mentioned, I was kind of thinking about this before the show. It feels like county politics, and I'm talking about like county government politics, not like the entire body politic of St. Louis County, which includes state legislative seats. Mm-hmm. It's been kind of in a state of like stalledness. Stalledness isn't a word, but like...
I'm with you.
Since 2019, like, you know, Sam Page has been county executive. People don't like Sam Page. He wins in 2020, he wins in 2022. It's just sort of the same old fights between the county executive and the county council. Do you see that changing? Is that a bad thing that there's not like agreement between those two sides? And is there any benefit to actual people if there's like a radical change in how like St. Louis County government works? Because it's certainly fun to describe in the abstract of politics, but like county government is supposed to do things for people. And I'm just sort of curious about like, do you think like where we are now is actually serving them?
That's a lot in that question.
I know. And it wasn't the most that wasn't the most artful question because I woke up at 5:22 today, but continue.
So I think that we are in St. Louis County, we are in the middle of a transformative phase in that we've had two or three county executives in the past decade, and the county council, which stayed the same for a bit, has seen some turnover and may see some more turnover here soon. So I think that the personas on the St. Louis County Council and in the St. Louis County executive spot have mixed up quite a bit. And then if we bring in the county government overall, the assessor's office has only been around for as an elected office for maybe 10 years.
Yeah, about 10 or 11 years. But yeah, continue.
The county prosecutor spot was held by the same person for two or three decades. So I think that there's just, we're in a stage transition. And I think that it's a good thing that there hasn't been such radical transition all at one time, because I think that gives more potential for chaos to happen, if you will. So it's a good thing that it's been quiet, or maybe it's a good thing that a lot of the energy, a lot of the political energy has been channeled into one specific event.
Which is the first congressional district race, right? Yeah. Which was my next question. Why do you think Wesley Bell was able to win? I mean, I know a lot of people have just been like, he had more money and he had the pro-Israel groups, but I feel like that doesn't really tell the whole story. Like, he won most of the townships in St. Louis County, including black majority townships that Cori Bush won in 2022. Like, something happened to where Bush's support in the places where she needed to win, namely, like, North St. Louis County, really went down considerably. So I'd be interested in your theories about what happened there.
So I think that the easy answer to that would be the money. I think that Congressman-elect Bell was able to get his message out a lot more clearly and a lot more repetitively. But I think that there was also, within that message, Congressman-elect Bell was able to tell people what he was going to bring to the district and how that was different from what they was getting. So I think that that's really, I think, the big thing that happened there. I think that there was some headlines that hurt Congresswoman Bush, and I think that with that money being in the race, it was easy to capitalize upon that.
I follow often, like, where electeds gravitate in races like this. So there are some people who are clearly on Cori Bush's side. There are some who are on Wesley Bell's side. What I noticed is I didn't see you, Senator Williams, Senator May. I don't think any of you were saying much of anything about that race. And I felt that was pretty notable, because I think all of you are not seen as Cori Bush super fans. But was that kind of a collective sign that you were not all comfortable with the way Wesley Bell navigated into that race? Or am I just reading way too much into this and I need to get a hobby, basically?
Well, I think that you're good at your job, Jason. One of my favorite reporters, since you made me pick a favorite politician on the other side of the aisle. Independence is important in politics, and I appreciate that sometimes folks don't make endorsements in races. And that's what I decided not to do, because personally, I was not the biggest fan of the work that Congresswoman Bush did in Washington, D.C. However, I was a big proponent of having a black progressive county prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And having what seemed like a choice between those two dynamics left me in an uneasy position. But I can appreciate Congressional District 1 being vied for by two independent politicians that definitely showed that they know the craft in one way or the other.
And I think it's going to continue like this. Like, I think there's the first district primary is going to be competitive, like, every cycle. Like, I don't think Wesley Bell's going to get a pass in 2026, just like Cori Bush didn't get a pass in her first 2 years. And you could make an argument that's not a bad thing, because it forces the office holder to be accountable. But I'll be very candid, like, these primaries for the first district, even going back to, like, when Lacey Clay was primaried, they've been really nasty, and they've brought out, like, really angry feelings from people. But at the same time, like, that's just the way elections work, I suppose. So
sometimes that's the way elections work. I think that it was much different, in my opinion, when Congressman Clay was the congressperson. Yeah. He was pretty well a lock in every primary that he had after his first primary all the way back in the day.
Yeah, I understand right. that. So,
but I think that when we talk about this position being in flux, if you will, I think that it's a good thing because we're seeing in what direction the congressional district truly wants to go. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's different directions in different years, and that can be counterproductive in the Washington, D.C. grand scheme of things because Congress runs by seniority. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we have representation that truly represents us in Washington, D.C. at the same time. And that's the reason why we have two-year congressional or two-year House appointments and six-year Senate appointments so that Congress can be more responsive to the people if we're going back to civics class.
Final question for you. Will you ever run for office again, or is this it?
I think that it's possible that I run for elected office again. I don't think that it's in the short-term future for me, but I think it's possible.
So I should not expect a Kevin Windham for state senate or Kevin Windham for county council signs to pop up over North County in 2026.
I would be a bad politician to say never, but I don't see it.
Yeah. Well, Representative, it's been a pleasure having you today. It's been a pleasure getting to know you over the last few years. And I wish you the best in your future endeavors, which is something that usually gets said to a WWE wrestler who gets fired. So let's leave it at that. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. You can find all of our stories at stlpr.org. And how can people find you on the World Wide Web where you want to be found? Or do you just never want to be found again?
I don't know if I ever want to be found on World Wide Web again. But no, I'm kidding. You can always email me at K. What is my email address? KevinWindham85@gmail.com.
Thank you very much. Until then, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lippman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio, this is Politically Speaking.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.